called Can War Be Just in the 21st Century? And she's authored articles on war and peacemaking, particularly on Catholic peacebuilding efforts. This comes in part, I think, from her participation in San Egidio, which is a Catholic lay organization that's committed to prayer and service for the poor and involved in peace and reconciliation movements. She holds a PhD in theological ethics from Boston College, as well as degrees from the University of Virginia and Harvard Divinity School. And Lori, we're just delighted to have you at the Blasey Center today. Look forward to what you might have to say. So she'll speak for 10 minutes or so, and then we'll have a chance to have a conversation.
Thank you very much, Suzanne, for the gracious introduction. It's always fun to be back here. Today I wanted to just start a conversation about the connections between war and the environment. How can we bring environmental considerations more into the conversation about war? But then also, how can we bring war and military efforts more into the conversation about the environment and climate change? And I'll just point you to a couple of places in which I see a lack on both sides, a lack that is hopefully going away. But the Paris climate talks that happened in December marked a really significant change in how environmental agreements have dealt with war and the military. So in 1997, when the Kyoto Protocols were signed, there was an explicit exception made for all military endeavors. So when governments committed to track their emissions and to reduce their emissions, there was an automatic exception. They weren't going to count or track any of their emissions due to their military activities or make any attempt to reduce them. So in fact, what was possible under the Kyoto Protocols was for countries' overall emissions to go up dramatically and have it look on paper like they had gone down because all military missions were excluded. So in this very odd way, it's as if the considerations about climate excluded military activity as this exceptional thing that didn't need to be considered or counted in the same way as sort of ordinary human activities, like, you know, how do we power our homes? How do we, you know, drive our cars? Those kinds of ordinary activities, which are part of the conversation about climate change, are the focus, and military activities are the exception somehow, which is, of course, highly problematic because of the dramatic effect that military activities have on climate change and global warming. And it's very hard to get, of course, it's hard to come up with reliable, clear estimates of sort of the carbon footprint of all of the world's militaries. But some of the best estimates I've seen suggests that about 20% of all carbon emissions in the world are due to militaries. So that's, you know, one-fifth, so that's pretty substantial. In the United States alone, the Department of Defense consumes more oil than the entire country of Sweden. And apart from countries as a whole, the U.S. military is the single largest consumer of oil in the world, institutionally speaking, apart from countries. So clearly there's an enormous impact. On the other hand, when you look at the ethics of war and how the conversation about just war and just war theory has taken place over the last few decades, I find that there's a remarkable lack of discussion about the environmental impact of war. There's starting to be more and more, but I'll give you an example. During the first Gulf War, Saddam Hussein's troops, when they were retreating, set fire to oil wells and created just a massive environmental disaster in the Persian Gulf. Really, really dreadful. And yet, when George W. Bush was considering going to war again in Iraq, the second Gulf War, there was a very lively public debate about that, lots of protests, but there was almost no discussion of the potential environmental impact of that proposed war. And you see this even in many of the formal statements by the U.S. Catholic bishops, by other religious bodies. There's no mention of the possible environmental impact of a second Gulf War, which in a way is not surprising, but I found it a little shocking just given how just what a major environmental impact the first Gulf War had had, and how much publicity there was around that. I would have expected to be at least part of a conversation, but I find almost no reference to it, other than a few, you know, environmental advocacy groups who were, of course, raising that. But it wasn't part of the general conversation very much. So on both sides of this intersection, I see the need for sort of more focused conversation. One of the real strengths of Pope Francis's recent encyclical Laudato Si on the environment is his very clear acknowledgement of the way everything is interconnected, right? Which lays wonderful groundwork for talking about the connections between environmental damage, war, the human cost of war, the environmental cost of war as being deeply interconnected. And there are, of course, lots of ways that we can illustrate that. Plenty of examples in the world today of the way environmental damage is provoking conflict or aggravating conflict. There have been some recent studies about the war in Syria showing that one of the major factors is that there's been a drought in Syria. The Arab Spring, to some extent, was provoked by rising food costs because of climate change leading to agricultural problems. A number of conflicts in Africa right now are being aggravated or even provoked by the Sahara Desert moving south, essentially, and so arable land becoming more scarce. There are many examples of this kind of thing happening all over the world. Increasing numbers of climate refugees, that's a new term, right? But it's an accurate term. So there are plenty of examples of that. Even emerging epidemics, the Zika virus, and other health issues, which then lead to political instability and can in some cases provoke violent conflict. These are also due to the warming climate. So there are lots of ways in which this is a major factor. In terms of the impact of war on the environment, there are also plenty of examples you can look at throughout history. This is not a new topic. It's just that the scale is new. I've already mentioned the first Gulf War. The war in Vietnam, of course, is infamous for the environmental impacts there. About 10% of the entire territory of Vietnam was sprayed with Agent Orange during the Vietnam War. And it's interesting that only in 2012 did the United States government, for the first time, authorize funds to start cleaning up Agent Orange, even though it's been in the water supply, polluting it, causing birth defects for decades. There are plenty of examples of the way conflicts create both human costs and environmental costs at the same time as well. So, for instance, if you have a conflict leading to a refugee flow, obviously the human impact of that is really significant, but it also frequently leads to environmental degradation as you have massive numbers of refugees needing wood and causing deforestation. In Afghanistan, over the last couple of decades, the forest cover has been reduced in half. And if you look at satellite photos of Afghanistan, it's really horrifying to see just how much green is gone, partly because of social instability and people needing to cut down wood to survive, to heat their homes, but also due to a lot of timber smuggling because of political chaos and instability. Not a consequence of the war in Afghanistan that you see discussed all the time, but a really significant one for the environment there, for climate overall. I should note that there are, of course, some cases also when what's good for humans and what's good for the environment in relation to war do conflict. One of the interesting things about, for instance, the demilitarized zone at the border between North and South Korea is that it's become a hotspot for environmental biodiversity because no humans are going there, right? So instead, nature can flourish. It's, you know, not a lovely image of environmental health because there are also loads of landmines there. So every once in a while, you know, some animal steps on a landmine and gets blown to bits. But in any case, the biodiversity is really fantastic. So obviously, there's some ways in which war can be good for the environment by removing humans' impact on the environment. And then another sort of example of how environmental protection can be problematic for war is that there are a number of nature preserves in African countries where the nature preserves have actually provided shelter for militia groups who then use them as launching points for carrying out violent attacks. So wonderful that there's a nature preserve, but there's this terrible side effect that it allows shelter for violent groups to hide out. So I don't want to suggest that environmental damage and the human cost are always hand in hand. There's sometimes where, of course, they conflict. Far more often, though, as Pope Francis says in Laudato Si, the human environment and the natural environment degrade together. And that's more often the norm. So then what? In thinking about how to assess all of this, I've spent a long time thinking about just war theory and was looking to it as a way to help me think about, you know, how do you assess the environmental consequences of war in relation to other consequences? How do we think about environmental damage proactively in advance of a war, as well as sort of when a war is ongoing? And the just war theory is a really useful tool for analyzing when a war might be justified. And one of the core components of it is what's called the principle of proportionality. And I think that's a really useful principle for helping us think about environmental damage. So just briefly, proportionality is, I see it in some ways as the core of the just war theory, because it's really what separates just war doctrine from either pacifism on one side or realism on the other side. Both pacifism and realism are not concerned with the costs of war. So a pacifist would say, you know, war is wrong no matter what the consequences, no matter what the costs, war is wrong, should not be an option. A realist would say, you know, if a war serves the national interest, it doesn't matter what the cost is in terms of civilian casualties at the extreme. So just war theory is an attempt to be a more moderate position and to say sometimes the damage done in a war, the violence that's carried out, is less harmful overall than whatever the objective is of the just war. Sometimes it's worth going to war to protect innocent civilian populations, to address major injustices. So it's an attempt to sort of weigh the possible justice of a war against the negative consequences. I see it as a way for, in the Christian tradition, to try to balance Jesus's two commandments to love your enemies and love your neighbors, right? Which those commandments sometimes conflict if your enemy is attacking your neighbor, right? So the just war theory says, no, you do have a duty to love your neighbor and protect your neighbors as much as you can, and you should still try to love your enemies as much as possible and moderate how you carry out wars, but sometimes the principle of loving your neighbor has to override the principle of not harming your enemy. Obviously, one of the harms of war is environmental damage. And in the just war theory, when we talk about proportionality, more often the questions have been about, you know, how many people are going to die in a war as a consideration, how much destruction to civilian infrastructure is going to happen, how many losses are our military going to suffer, for instance. But one of the costs is clearly the environmental impact. And so I think that really needs to be one of the calculations when you're considering whether or not a war is just. Are the environmental costs proportional to the good that you're hoping to achieve with the war? Obviously, that's a very difficult thing to calculate. And I don't want to suggest that proportionality in just war theory is just about numbers. It's not. Numbers are very important. And having the kind of expertise to really understand what the environmental impact is going to be in a quantitative way is very, very important, I think, as part of taking seriously whether or not a war is just. But it has to be more than numbers, because thinking about proportionality is really thinking about the weighing of values. And so we have to examine what it is that we value. How do we value the environment and why? That has to come into play when you're thinking about proportionality. I should back up just for a second. For those who are not as familiar with just war theory, a classic example that's given when people are talking about the doctrine of proportionality is that, for instance, if you have a very small weapons cache in the middle of a highly populated area, it wouldn't be proportional to mount a major military attack on that area just to seize a very small weapons cache. That would be disproportionate in the context of war. Proportionality is also something that has to be considered before war, so you don't mount a war because of one death, for instance. You don't risk the lives of hundreds of thousands of other people because one person has suffered and died. That would be disproportionate. So it's a consideration both before going to war and sort of at each step of the way along during a war. So ad bellum and also in bello. So I'm part of what I'm hoping to have a conversation with you all about today is, as we think about proportionality and what's valued and how to weigh environmental damage, I think it requires thinking about who we are as people and what sort of attitudes towards the environment are necessary in order for us to have to effectively assess whether environmental damage is justified. That is, as I said, about having good data and having an understanding of the way ecosystems work. But I do think it's also about character, about culture, about how we approach the environment. Do we have an attitude of this is disposable, this is here for us to make use of however we like? Or is our attitude something else? And I think this is especially challenging in a military context because, first of all, part of military training is, in fact, helping people to become more callous in a certain way, right? In order to prepare to kill, you have to be somewhat at least desensitized to the act of killing. And the same thing happens, I think, in regard to the environment very often, a sort of a desensitization to the environment. Warfare is fundamentally about destroying things. So there has to be a certain level of desensitization to destroying the environment that is part of military preparations. So I wonder how to mitigate that. I think some of it depends on the larger culture as a whole. I also want to note, though, that the U.S. military is actually in some ways ahead of the curve on a lot of these issues, certainly ahead of our political conversation. There's already a great deal of conversation about converting military vehicles to alternative fuel sources, right? And obviously that's, in many cases, for strategic reasons. If you have gas-guzzling tanks out in the field, it's very difficult to constantly be refueling them. So you need more energy-efficient tanks for strategic purposes. But even beyond that, I think just as in some cases some of the most difficult questions about civilian casualties have been raised by soldiers who are there witnessing them, I think some of the most profound questions about environmental damage in war are also being raised within the context of the military, where people are observing these things. And in 2010, the U.S. Army put out an operations manual called Environmental Considerations. It is a fascinating document. And it's fascinating to me that it exists, that, you know, officers in the United States Army are expected as part of their normal, you know, command operations to take into consideration the environment in an explicit way. And it's quite systematic. There's also some really interesting moral language in it that I'll read to you because I find it so fascinating. Oops. There we go. This is from the beginning of the 200-page field manual. From every philosophical or moral perspective, environmental stewardship and sustainment is the right thing to do. As humans make more demands on the shrinking resource base, ethical issues become clearer. Senior leaders must create ethical climates, This is, again, my question about attitudes. Ethical climates in which subordinate leaders recognize that the natural resources of the earth are exhaustible, that the environment has an impact on human health, and that they must take responsibility to protect the environment. I don't know about you, but I would love to see some of our congressmen abide by a statement like that. So in some ways, the military is right out there ahead of us. I don't want to suggest that everything's perfect. The manual also is highly problematic in a number of different ways. One of the examples it gives of how we need to protect the environment better is that we should try not to track mud onto roadways. Which, okay, great, but that's, you know, hardly the biggest problem. And that's the very first example. Right. You know, okay, tanks need to not track mud onto roadways. Okay. And there are also some very funny turns of phrase in it. There's one point where it talks about how this is a statement that I find ironic unintentionally. Protecting natural resources and the facilities exploiting them are now major components of military planning. So protecting natural resources and the facilities exploiting them are things that we need to focus on. Okay, so we're going to protect them, but then we're also going to protect our ability to exploit them, which those things kind of conflict. I understood what they mean, but I find that kind of amusing. So, in some ways, I do think the military is out ahead of the rest of our culture in this way, but I also think it's up to sort of us civilians and societies as a whole to really think about, okay, how can we create a culture and a set of attitudes and a set of character traits which allow us to be sensitive enough to environmental concerns that it really does become part of the conversation about war and the understanding about why war is something to be limited at all costs in many ways because of the environmental consequences, and then also sensitive to the ways in which our climate conversation hasn't included all the pieces of the conversation, and bringing in the fate of environmental refugees and other forms of collateral damage of climate change, and the ways that it provokes conflict into the broader conversation about our carbon footprints and how to reduce those as well. So,
great. Thank you so much.